I'm going to say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. I've got Harry Brule. He's the head of our board of directors at KHEN Radio. And I want to say first, the views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And I also want to mention that the program is archived at www.givemesometruth.info. So if you want to go back and refer to any of the past programs, I have tried to archive almost all of them, and that goes back, you know, almost 4 years now. So, and I'm real excited to have Harry Brule. He is recent to KHEN Radio, but in the meantime, Harry is quite a background, and I'm just real excited to have him here with us because he's got such a background that I just have all kinds of questions and want to say, wow. He's head of, or senior vice president, is that right?
Nice. It's a title I still keep, yep. That title and $3.75 will get you cappuccino anywhere, so.
And he's really a nice down-to-earth guy. That's what, and yet he's senior vice president of PDI Ninth House, Global Leadership Solutions. And it looks like Global Leadership Solutions has just recently merged with Personal Decisions Incorporated and Personal Decisions International. So you're saying that Personal Decisions Incorporated is your original company, is that right?
Yeah, we started as a one-office firm in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and now we're expanded to about 13 U.S. offices in 29 countries. So we went from incorporated to international, and then our latest iteration, we purchased a global training organization out of San Francisco called Ninth House. So we now have the somewhat unwieldy name of PDI Ninth House. So,
well, one of the things that I like doing what I'm doing is I'm never going to be a polished interviewer, but I've had such great luck at finding some great people to interview. And I guess what I'd like you to do is kind of give a little background to our audience to, you know, how you got here and why you're doing what you're doing.
I'm not sure which part of what I'm doing you're interested in, but I can talk about how I got here because that's simple and probably not atypical and a lot of fun. In 2000, and my dates may be off a year or two here, but I came out here on Ride the Rockies from St. Paul, Minnesota, and overnighted in Salida, and ate some good pizza, had some good beer, just thought the people I met in this town were down to earth and not pretentious. And then the next year, I came out again, this time with my wife, and we both rode. And again, overnighted in Salida. And this time I turned to her and said, let's look for a place here. And after she said, you're crazy, that's my phone. And we will turn that off. I apologize for that. So after we got that out of the way, we came back and looked at properties and found a house and got to finish building it, and it was sort of stalled in construction, and visited vacation time, etc., until 2009 when I changed my work status to half-blank retired and moved our center of gravity out here. So it's Labor Day. This year was 2 years, so we've been out here 2 years now.
Well, you do a lot of traveling around with your occupation. And at the same time, one of the things that I found quite interesting was, you know, you come back with Ithaca. Is that where you?
I went to college in Ithaca, New York, and tried very hard not to grow up, and that meant don't leave a college town. So I came in 1966, I think I came to Ithaca, and managed to stay until 1977, so.
Okay, and you were telling me that you'd built your house there. Is that right?
Yeah, one of the things I did back in the day before I knew any better was purchase some land and built a log house that had plumbing and heat and electricity and all those. Whoops. Something just went dead.
No, you're done. You shouldn't be dead.
Oh, I'm not dead? Okay,
no,
good.
I just changed. There was a reverberation going
on. Oh, okay. But I don't hear it in the speakers, in my headphones anymore. Anyway, went to Ithaca, and after I graduated college, built a house and lived in the country for a while, which was just a great place to be.
So. Well, then maybe I should have to push another button again. Okay, because the headphones may be changed around. So that's okay. I was just ringing in here, and that was why I had to change the sound a little bit. But, you know, this is community radio, and we're that's what makes it fun, because, you know, sometimes it's you just have to just go with the flow. And as far as the I'm still learning some of the equipment, and I've been at this, 5 years. So I hope Harry will have a little bit of patience with me while I'm trying to work the board here a little bit. But as far as what you're doing, you have a background in psychology, right?
I have a background in a corner of psychology called industrial organizational psychology, which is actually quite different from what most people think about when they think of psychology. So,
okay. Explain that a little bit.
Well, there are a couple of ways I can do this because I've been explaining it for 34 years. If I were to be kind of accurate, one of my colleagues said, in the world of work, and I guess, first of all, my brand of psychology functions in the work world, and it really has to do for people and for organizational units, defining what's important, attempting to measure it, and at times attempting to enhance it or grow it. So we do a lot of work in personnel selection, helping organizations define what they're looking for in everything from entry-level positions to the top, and then measuring the capabilities of people against that blueprint or template and saying, here's where they fit and here's where they miss. Since there are no perfect people, our job is to decide what their strengths are and where they could develop. Another way to think about it is there are three kinds of psychologists. There are researchers, there are helpers, and there are meddlers. And industrial organizational psychology is mostly about meddling. So we are consultants. My firm is a firm of consultants who work with all organizations around the world, both private and public sector, and help them with the people side of business, particularly around leadership issues. So I have a couple of particular areas of interest and expertise that I've developed. One is working with government and not-for-profits. So I do a lot of work, particularly in law enforcement and fire, where I do selection and promotional procedures. And then I have some expertise in the legal side, doing support for trial in terms of expert witness work and consultation. So
now, does that tie in with the other?
Yes, only in the sense that there are probably proportionally more lawsuits around people in law enforcement and fire who don't get what they want in terms of promotion. So therefore, they have a vested interest in actually undoing the process and having a new process. So one of the ways to do that is to allege in court that something was flawed. So.
Huh. Now, I wasn't expecting that avenue. But that's great, because, I mean, there's so many different directions to go with this interview. But, I mean, because just in the law enforcement aspects, but when I go and I look at it, it's kind of like you're a headhunter?
No, because we don't hunt the heads. The heads are already there. And in most cases, the organization has already identified, let's talk about executive selection, which you think of headhunting. The organization has usually identified a few people, either internally or externally, who are potential for the position, and our job is to measure their capabilities against what the organization needs. Now, in the public sector, I do some recruitment, but I always say you don't have to hunt for police chief candidates. You know where they are. They work in police departments. So it's really a question of just notifying them and letting them know there's a position available, mm-hmm. and then letting them apply. And then winnowing the pool from however many apply down to usually it's a single person. You usually have just one chief of police, for example. So,
okay, so how did you get into this particular business? I mean, did you start it from the ground up?
Well, there are two ways people pursue careers. One is planned and linear, and you climb ladders and you have it mapped out. And the other, one of my colleagues calls the barnacle theory, which says you float along and you brush up against a lot of things, and every once in a while you stick. I have a very checkered background, so without getting into too much detail, I started pre-med with a degree in biology. I then taught elementary school. I then was a drug counselor, a probation officer, a therapist, and then I went from doing therapy to doing training and consultation, and none of that involved psychology, really, until I ended up going to graduate school in psychology later and putting the kind of the science to it.
So did you give us your college that you went to?
No, I have an undergraduate degree from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, which is what got me to Ithaca. And I have a master's from the State University of New York at Cortland, New York. And then I did my doctoral work, but didn't quite finish, at the University of Minnesota. So
sounds like you've led quite an interesting life. So when you had this company come together, did you, like, just a couple of guys that get together? Or?
Actually, the company predates me by probably another 10 years. A professor at the University of Minnesota, who is one of the founders, really, of the field of industrial organizational psychology, Marvin Dinette, and the head of human resource research at 3M Company, named Wayne Kirchner, actually bought a little firm from the widow of an individual who'd been doing some consulting, and they started what was then called PDI, or Personnel Decisions Incorporated. Their first hire was a young graduate student named Lowell Hellervick, who is still the primary owner of PDI. So when I came in 1977, they had literally just split into a for-profit consulting firm and a nonprofit research organization. So I joined a firm of already about 11 people total in downtown Minneapolis. And after doing a project writing volumes of an encyclopedia to develop people at Control Data, my second project was selecting the police chief of Minneapolis. And that was just fun. And the individual who ultimately got selected is still a friend today, and that was 33 years ago. So it kind of got me hooked, and I stayed. And I like to say I ran our first foreign office. So Minneapolis was headquarters, and our first satellite or foreign office was St. Paul across the river, so approximately 7 miles away.
So is when you're looking for, say, these police chiefs, as opposed to going through another type of CEOs or people that are hired by different companies, do you find that it's a total different thing to be doing here, or is it similar?
Very interesting question. Let me put it this way. It's more similar than different, because ultimately people in leadership roles need to satisfy the constituents of that role. And, you know, for a CEO in business, it's the board of directors. For a police chief, it's the city council, as well as everyone else who is involved. And then ultimately it's about getting things done through other people. No police chief does everything by his or herself. Him or herself, and no CEO does all the company's business. alone. So it's actually more similar than different. It's kind of surprising. I mean, people make choices about the careers they follow, and they develop different technical expertise. Although once you get to the top of any organization, your technical expertise probably gets more and more irrelevant. I once had an argument with a city councilman in Minneapolis. I had done a fire chief selection for the city, and I was asked on television whether I had assessed or measured the candidate's ability to fight fires. And I kind of knew it was coming, I guess, or I made it up. I can't remember which, but I remember my response, which was asking if the fire chief of Minneapolis can fight fires is like asking if the president of Pillsbury knows how to bake. And in both cases, it's irrelevant. And so I think the short answer to your question is much more similar than different.
That's presents some interesting thoughts in my mind. I mean, I understand exactly where you're coming from when you're stating this, but at the same time, so it's more of a people management and operations thing than it is about, the logistics of the job itself. But when you have police chiefs, do they change as much, say, like than CEOs of companies? When I look at some of those, a lot of times those change like musical chairs. But I don't see that as much in police chiefs. Am I incorrect?
You're probably right. And it makes it interesting, which means that the importance of the decision for a police chief may be somewhat larger than a CEO, particularly if you have a revolving door kind of policy. Now, it varies. I mean, there are municipalities like Los Angeles where every time they have a crisis in law enforcement, they have them on a regular basis, one of the things they do, it's an easy way to show you're doing something, is get rid of the top person. And I actually got interviewed by Los Angeles Times after one of the police chiefs, didn't change, got fired after he was hired to change the department, and he didn't do it. And they were saying, well, why didn't he do it? And I'm saying, because there's no one person alone isn't going to change an institution and a culture that's been around as long as it has and as solid as it has, particularly since almost everyone else in the organization has been there for a long time. Not only at the chief level, but people don't realize this, in law enforcement, fire and corrections, the uniformed services, people can't sell their expertise to anyone else. If you want to get promoted, you're going to do it in your own organization. Otherwise, you start at the bottom again. The only lateral entry, entry from the outside, is at the top. And so careers, people literally hire on and retire from pretty much the same department they start in. And that's got implications, particularly if you're trying to change an organization.
Okay, now, so you deal with police chiefs. Do sheriffs come into this?
Mm-hmm. Sheriffs are elected.
Right.
And if I'm being charitable, and this is no offense to any sheriff or any other elected official, but the truth of the matter is the only known quality of an elected official is the ability to get elected. Generally speaking, there are no other criteria. Now, at least in my knowledge, a sheriff needs to be a licensed peace officer, so there are some in other words, they have to have gone through a training at the police peace officer level, law enforcement level. But beyond that, in terms of their leadership, in terms of their ability to work through people, et cetera, in terms of all the other things, it's the voters who make the decision. No one else. There is no professional assessment involved.
So is there a way that you can help them at all, work with them?
Well, yes, but not at their selection, but certainly in helping them select their key people around them, so a deputy mm-hmm. sheriff or an undersheriff or chief deputy, as well as designing the selection and promotional procedures below them in the process.
Okay.
So I've worked with as many sheriff's departments probably as police agencies, but not at the top position. No one's ever asked me to help find a sheriff.
Well, I can understand that part, but I with all the other background around your business, then it would appear that what you're talking about would make a lot of sense for them once they understood what you do. So.
Yeah.
Okay, now, when you're looking at, you know, I mean, it's a lot different looking at a CEO as opposed to the people around them. Am I making sense here?
You might. the question is, am I understanding it?
Okay, all right. Well, that's not uncommon for me to present something like that.
I do say that in one's career, depending on how it unfolds, you know, every new position is a step. And two steps in one's career are larger than any other. And some people never take either. Some people take one. Some people take both. The first is when you become responsible not only for your own actions and results, but somebody else's. So when you move into supervision or management, that's a big jump. And some people do very well at being an individual contributor, but have a very hard time making that leap.
Mm-hmm.
The second jump, and this is one that fewer people make, is when you're top dog or head chicken, if we're using K-head, because there's no one else to blame. There's nobody else to turn to. So the difference between being a CEO or a police chief, everyone has somebody they report to, everyone has someone to answer to, but when you're basically in that top rank and you have to make the decisions, and sometimes they're tough ones, that's a responsibility. My favorite quote is they were asking CEOs about whether they worried, whether they were anxious about their company performance. And the head of Coca-Cola, whose name I can never remember, it's an Italian name, said he slept like a baby. He said he woke up every 2 hours and cried. And I loved it because it is a responsibility and it's a big one. And, you know, you're responsible for a lot of people's lives, a lot of people's jobs, as well as all those things that, like shareholders and everything else that, you know.
Do you find that the CEOs go sideways? Do they go move around to other companies as CEOs, or do they just kind of disappear?
It varies. I mean, you find CEOs who have moved from one business to another. You find CEOs that move within a kind of industry among different people. I mean, you look at Steven Jobs from Apple. I mean, if I remember right, he was in Pepsi at one point.
Really?
Yeah, and he was at Apple more than once because he'd gotten fired and rehired at Apple. So, and then when he was fired, he started Pixar Studios. So, yeah, I mean, the talents to be successful as a CEO are relatively transferable across companies and across industries.
Okay, do you find, with what you're doing with these upper management, will you find that some of them are figureheads more, or are they more active? Does that happen?
I don't think I have enough personal experience at the corporate boardroom, mm-hmm, to know. I'm sure some of my colleagues could give you more anecdotal and even statistical information about that. Mm-hmm. I do know, because I spent most of my professional career focusing, as I said, on public sector, so city managers, department heads, as well as police and fire. And then also not-for-profits, so that I have...
So you're not really in those areas where it's as much where they have a tendency to... I mean, you'll find that with politicians quite often. It seems like they will kind of move into these arenas. And unless I'm misunderstanding what I read in some of these boards or on the boards, do you find that at all, or...?
Well, again, I don't have the depth of experience. I've worked with some top executives along the way in private industry,
mm-hmm,
but I've worked more with city managers and city councils, county boards, and so that's probably been where I've and then not-for-profit boards, because it's kind of how I got to Cahan, is that I have a background both in my professional life of helping select executive directors for not-for-profits, but also having sat on probably over a dozen boards in my life and been the board chair.
So they're kind of a different animal then.
Yeah, again, there are differences between public and private sector, between not-for-profit and for-profit organizations, and one can focus on those differences or one can focus on the similarities. And in some ways, they're more similar. I think, again, there are probably more similarities than different, but, there's a bottom line difference. A not-for-profit is usually there to provide a service meet a need, whereas a for-profit's reason for being is to find a need and make a profit in meeting it. And so although I remember an individual who was the chief financial officer for a not-for-profit who had a sign on his door that said, "A not-for-profit that fails to make a profit goes out of business." And so if you think about it, you do need to sustain yourself and you do need to ideally have some cushion in the bank. The question is, where does that money go? Does it go into someone's shareholders' pockets or does it go into a reserve fund? Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty subtle difference, actually. So.
I had a question there, and it's going to have to come back to me again because, I know what it is now. Have you found that has changed at all over the period of time that you've been working with this organization?
That's a good question. I think all professions have changed over the 34 years I've been at this. In part because technology has changed, and all professions in some way or other depend on technology. Some professions have changed dramatically for other reasons, and I'll use law enforcement as an example. In the old days, first of all, the original cops in America were big Irish guys who could intimidate through just their presence and could beat you up if intimidation didn't work. And the job of law enforcement was to catch bad guys. That's really changed. There are very few police agencies in this country that haven't adopted some form of what's called community-oriented policing or problem-oriented policing, which basically says our job is to help the community solve problems. So if we have an area of our community with a high crime rate, our job is not to go catch the criminals after they've done bad things. Our job is to figure out what are the causes of crime in that community and work in partnership with that community to reduce crime, which is a very different orientation than what used to be and requires a different skill set, a different mindset, a different hiring set than, hey, we're going to give you a gun, we're going to have you go out and catch bad guys.
Okay, now, my observation, when you go in that direction, I see more of a militaristic flavor than what I remember back when I was a child. I mean, I'm probably the same age as you. So and I remember Barney Fife and
that was, I'm sorry, that was never law enforcement.
It was the image, I guess.
Neither is CSI, the way investigative work goes. So, law enforcement has always been what's called a paramilitary organization. Not only uniforms and not only weapons, but a lot of things they borrowed from the military. But I'd say they've moved more away from that than they used to. And fire is another example. Fire is a paramilitary organization in crisis and emergency situations, i.e. war. Buildings on fire, that's a war scene. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, fire departments are doing far more education, far more fire prevention, inspections of buildings to make sure they are safe, and now involved in a lot of homeland security kind of things on the local level. So it's again, moving away from, in a lot of cases, being a paramilitary when they need to. I would say a SWAT team, which we all know from television in the police world, that's a military operation. Mm-hmm. That's really no different than a mission, a military mission in a war scene. But most of the time, thank goodness, in most communities, cops are not donning their SWAT uniforms and vests and doing the kind of work that SWAT teams do. It's an occasional kind of thing. And the rest of the time, when you're working with a housing project, for example, trying to figure out ways to make it less crime, less of an easy target for crime, that's not a military operation. That's a community partnership. And so it's actually, I think, a much more gratifying occupation than it used to be. So.
Okay, well, I'm going to say that I've got Harry Brule, who is the president of our board of directors at KHAN Radio, and he's also senior vice president of PDI Ninth House. Is that how you do, or did you add the whole name?
No, it's PDI Ninth House these days, yep.
And so we're having a conversation, and he's giving us information on his background, because I find it quite interesting. I mean, we haven't even scratched the surface on several things that I have questions about, because in this day and age, understanding what they're looking for personnel, I mean, there's a lot of people that would love to know what's going on there, right?
Well, yeah, there is. And I taught at the collegiate level in Minneapolis for the last 17 years, and I would have students who would be, you know, going out from college into the work world, and of course, they were always concerned about their ability to land the job and land the right job and choose the right career and make all those important decisions. And so my field has a piece of it certainly involved in that side of it, which is helping people understand their strengths, understand their passions, and then kind of translate that into, okay, how do I make a career out of that? Because I would tell my students, if you find something you're good at, you like to do, and someone's going to pay you for, that's a pretty good trifecta. That's called a career. So.
Well, I played an interview last week with John Taylor Gatto, and he was a renowned educator, and from New York, and he pretty much presented the same thing, only he didn't necessarily do it via the classroom. He was taking those students out into the community and saying, well, you like this, why don't you go out and check that out? And he was finding great success in that.
I've spoken to a number of groups. I do a lot of what I call lip flapping, and one of them has been schools and people involved in career kinds of decisions. And I think that something we don't talk about much when we talk about public schooling in this country, besides skill development, which of course is important, is helping students orient toward careers. And, theoretically we have guidance counselors, but if you look at the caseloads of guidance counselors and you look at what they're actually doing, they're really not getting down at the level of helping students understand either what they happen to be good at or what really is exciting. And, their tests, for example, we know more about the kinds of occupations that excite people and the differences in that, career preferences, if you want to call it that. That's been probably more studied in psychology, in my world of psychology, than almost anything else. And we know with a pretty good degree of precision, we can test what a person really likes to do and help them decide whether, for example, at the most basic level, careers working with things versus careers working with people is a better fit for them. But most students don't really have much of a clue, and they stumble along. And the good news is, you know, it's usually not a life or death decision. So if people start out in engineering and realize it's not for them and go into other things, you know, they've wasted the wrong word. They've maybe delayed their career or taken side paths, but no great harm has been done. So it isn't a horrible thing. But I do think we could serve young people much better by helping them understand those two things, their strengths and their passions, and how that translates into the work world.
Well, I think sometimes you see that people try to gear towards where they think the markets are going to be and where their skills, you know, are going to be wanted. But that can be an expensive endeavor, particularly if you get in there and you find out your passion isn't there.
Yeah, and unfortunately for young people, a lot of career choices and college majors are not made on that level. They're made on pressure from people around them, mm-hmm. What their parents want them to do or be. And that's where the probability of a good fit may be even smaller. Because, you know, either doing what your parents did or having them push you away from that may or may not be right for you, because by definition you're not your parents. And so I was a good example. I started out pre-med and then along the line realized that I just wasn't a good fit for the kind of precision, for example, that medicine required. Just doesn't fit. I like to say that when I make mistakes, nobody dies. So you can't say that as a physician. So I realized probably around my junior year in college, so a little late, but early enough to have not invested the years, for example, in medical school, and then found out. So,
Did you find any of that background? Are you utilizing any of that background now?
there was a time when having a background in biology and chemistry was helpful in my eating habits, but other than that, professionally, no. I really have never used that background, although the training in general in science has been good, because industrial organizational psychology is a social science, and I do a fair amount of work involving measurement, statistics, et cetera, which, you know, is kind of a backbone of science, and so that's helpful. Uh-huh. But the specific stuff, the formulas and the pathways in biochemistry I learned, no.
Okay, so do you work with the human resources person?
Yeah, I would say that in many cases, I was on the phone today with a human resource person where the leadership of, happens to be a county, the leadership of a particular section in the county isn't doing what they need to do. So the job isn't getting done the way it's supposed to, and they want a proposal on what approach to work with probably the top four people in the organization to help them understand and be equipped to do what needs to be done. Because in the eyes of people who are judging, it's people above them in the organization, the job isn't getting done.
Okay, I hope I can state this question correctly, because when you have your business colleges that turn out a certain type of student, are they turning out the ones that are going to be successful in these higher positions or not?
Well, you're asking a generalization and a globalization, and certainly I would probably suggest that there is variety among business schools in terms of who they're turning out, and some do it better than others. If I was being kind of hard-nosed and cynical, if you look at the average starting salary of business students from the top-tier schools, mm-hmm. the Stanford, the Michigan, Harvard, University of Pennsylvania, Wharton, MIT, they're commanding new graduates are easily commanding over six figures as starting salaries, so they're doing something right. They're producing a product, students, that organizations, certain of them, are willing to pay for and they're willing to pay quite high sums. So at that basic level, and that's just sort of the bottom line level. Now, whether they're training them correctly, whether they're giving them the full skill set they need, we've done some partnership work with University of Minnesota Business School, for example, in helping teaching leadership skills to graduates, which is different than some of the hard-nosed business knowledge that you need, but leadership being the people side of it. So I think different schools do a more or less better job at doing that piece of the puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay, now, when you're saying that the nonprofits, do they, is there a relation between them and NGOs?
Yeah, NGO is a term that we use globally. It means non-governmental organization, but usually involved in some kind of people helping piece. So mm-hmm. I don't think we use the word NGO within the U.S. borders so much, but the Red Cross, for example, is an NGO. It's mm-hmm. not a governmental organization. It is international, and it's certainly involved in helping. Here we would call it a nonprofit, or we use the IRS code, a 501c3, which means they're a charitable organization under the tax code. But they are, and I would say internationally, they're probably considered like Doctors Without Borders, Red Cross, all those organizations that are not government affiliated.
So then again, this is where you've worked kind of in this arena, or?
I would say that my not-for-profit organization and work has been primarily limited to the U.S.,
okay.
Even though we've expanded across. I have had, I've dabbled a bit. I wrote a proposal for the school district in Singapore, which is it is a government because the entire country of Singapore runs their own school district. It's not like we have independent ones here. But that proposal never got off the ground, never got funded. So,
So when you go around outside of this country, then are you what avenue are you usually working in?
I haven't had as extensive experience. The times I've left the country, it's usually been management training, and it's usually been for large multinationals. So I've gone to Europe, I've gone to South America, and I've gone to Asia, but I've done training with management people for for-profit high-level managers generally. So.
Okay. So when you're saying multinational, are they usually ones that are affiliated with this country then?
Yeah, they're the big names that have operations all over in all the major continents basically.
Do you have a lot of competition in your arena?
Yeah, not a lot. There are a lot of small organizations, literally 1- and 2-person organizations who have relationships with particular companies, for example, and do work like ours. At the global level, there are really only 2 or 3 large organizations like ours. There used to be more, and recessions and downturns have impacted them, and there have been mergers and acquisitions. And so there really are, there's developmental dimensions out of Pittsburgh. Certainly there is a testing company out of England who is now connected with another group here in the U.S. But and in my particular sector, the public sector, there are a number of organizations within the U.S. who do, some of them do regional work, not a whole lot who do a lot of national work. So.
All right, one of the things that I'd kind of been watching a little bit of, and maybe you can identify this or not, but it looks to me like some of the larger corporations, multinational ones, are partnering with these non-governmental I don't know if there's so much 501c3, but I think some of the things that I've been watching take place, it appears that's happening. Am I right?
I have no clue. It's not, that is not something I could just not within my sight. So okay. I don't know.
Well, the only way I guess you would have. Well, I guess I won't go there, but that, I have watched some global meetings, and I'm not sure which one I've watched, but where it appeared that they were talking about this kind of a partnership thing taking place, and I can't say that I'm an expert on it. All I just thought I just caught some of that and thought maybe that you might be aware. Okay, I want to get back a little bit into the psychology of being able to go to some of these, or what they're looking for when they're hiring. Is that an across the board thing, or is it very job specific?
It's a great question. It's I think the answer, at least from my perspective, is clearly, every job has different requirements, but at the basic level, all jobs really boil down to probably about 6 or 7 key factors or skills, and starting with knowing something. Ditch diggers need to know what end of the shovel to use and when to stop digging. Neurosurgeons need to know a whole lot of different things. You also need to be able to use that knowledge and put it to use. So problem solving, decision making, applying knowledge. So there's that factor. And again, some jobs it's complex and other jobs it's relatively simple. There's always an administrative component, which is planning and organizing and detail orientation, sometimes paperwork handling. So even salespeople need to fill out orders correctly and in a timely fashion. There's a communication factor, since I like to say nobody gets paid for thinking great thoughts by themselves. So you got to talk, you got to listen, sometimes you have to write, sometimes you have to present. And again, jobs differ in what flavor of communication is required, but you usually have to do some communication. And then there's the people side, dealing with people. And again, there may be some jobs where that's minimal. You get locked in a cubicle someplace and you deal with a computer and not much else. But generally speaking, we work on teams. We work with clients or customers. We have to deal with bosses. We have to deal with peers. We have to deal with people who report to us, et cetera. And then some jobs require leadership, where you have to influence other people, get things done. You have to get people working as a team. And then the last two, no matter what the job is, you have to put effort into it. And, everything else being equal, success is perspiration as well as inspiration. So how hard do you work? How motivated are you to do what needs to be done, et cetera? Integrity, for example, is a motivational issue. Do you choose to do the right thing versus take shortcuts or do things that you shouldn't do? And then there's a last factor that we call self-management or adjustment, which is, can you function effectively under any and all conditions, including stress, adversity, outside problems? Do you not have personal issues like drugs, alcohol, etc.? Can you control your impulses such that you behave in a way that's considered appropriate and do the right thing? If you take it at that level, not only do all organizations, but all jobs require the same ingredients. Where it differs is the kind of knowledge, the level and importance and priority of various things that you need to do. Jobs differ tremendously in that. But at the basic level, I like to say that all jobs are like cake. There's lots of different kinds of cake, but the basic ingredients are pretty similar.
Okay. Again, I want to say this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and I've got Harry Brule, and his corporation is Personal Decisions International, or PDI Ninth House, which combined with PDI Ninth House, right? And let me ask you something here. What did they expect to accomplish when they merged with the other company? Anything?
Yeah, I'm sure they did. And since I wasn't I personally involved in the merger. One of the decisions I made, for example, along the way is that as we got larger and larger and the challenges of running a larger and larger business was not what I was particularly interested in or good at, that what I like to do is help clients solve problems. And so I, even though I have a title and even though I'm one of the more senior people in the organization, I have not sat in our own boardroom. So I wasn't part of the decisions to purchase Ninth House, which was a San Francisco-based global training, computer-based. They could deliver training around the world on the platform and the computer. We thought, I think, as an organization, that gave us some capability and expertise.
So it kind of expanded what you were already working at.
Right.
I mean, because you've got quite a few offices around the world now.
We do.
Okay. And I'm getting an opportunity that I don't get very often to have my guest in the room with me. And this is, I'm usually working over a phone or a computer and whatever, but this is fun. I've not gotten to do this much. Harry, do you find, this is one of the things that I find kind of, I have to scratch my head at sometimes, because I'm almost thinking I'm seeing a management method that doesn't necessarily try to treat their employees with a method that you would think they would want to. And do you see that out there? Is that a method management style?
Well,
or incompetence or what?
Here's a sobering statistic. When you ask people what's the most stressful part of your job, more than half of them answer their boss. And there's something wrong with that picture, clearly. I think probably a lot of reasons. I think, again, bosses vary from great to lousy. I think, unfortunately, most people who move into management roles aren't necessarily trained or even selected for their ability to manage. They're selected and trained in whatever they were technically involved in the first place, so engineers or salespeople or accountants or anything else. And I think the pressure of producing results, which we all have, sometimes gets in the way of that, and lack of knowledge and skill gets in the way, I think, of creating the right conditions for people to excel.
Okay. The reason why I kind of asked that question, I see some of this in some of the larger international companies where they're gearing down the hours, they're gearing down the flexibility, or that looking at, you know, working with the employees but making them rise to a level that's without the benefits or the pay or whatever. Do you see that at all? Am I just making that up?
Well, I can't answer whether you're making it up. I think the issues of compensation and downsizing and restructuring and all that, again, I'm not privy to those decisions, and I.
I guess what I understand where you're coming from, but I guess what I'm saying is I see this template taking place, and I don't know whether this is because they're really gearing in that direction, and they really want that type of management process, or if it's just, again, out of so many other factors come in there and they're not considering the employee.
Well, again, there are thousands of organizations in this country and in the world, and I don't think we can identify any particular style or approach that covers them all.
Right.
I do know this, that it's harder. It's harder to be successful, and there are lots of pressures, competition being one, global barriers, coming down being another. And so under pressure, and I would say I don't think there are any organizations that aren't under pressure, public or private. Certainly, the city of Salida is under financial pressure, as is Chaffee County. That I think under pressure, things that you might do that would benefit employees may take a second, a back seat. And sometimes decisions that are made out of economic necessity or out of economic pressure may not be as well thought through about the impact on people or even the communication. You know, for example, talk about layoffs. I have never met people who are laid off who felt, never is too strong. Generally speaking, people who are laid off usually feel that the communication and the way the layoffs happened was less than ideal. And maybe there is no good way to do it. Maybe there is no ideal way to do it. And, you know, bad news is bad news and pain is pain. But I think there are clearly, and we've worked with companies, for example, on this, there are clearly ways to do it better or worse. And
well, like some might give a little bit of a rumbling so that people can kind of get an idea something's going to happen, or the ones that can just, you just show up one day and you get a pink slip.
Well, and you've got to be careful, because when you start to rumble, those that can may jump ship, and those may not be the ones you want to jump ship, or those are the ones you need. And so there are pressures organizationally to keep a tight lid on some of that sometimes, and that's conflicting with giving people notice and helping them plan, et cetera. So, again, I don't want to defend corporations, and just as I don't want to indict them, but I think there are often competing pressures, and particularly in those tough situations, and I think layoffs are a particularly tough situation. I mean, I love the stories I hear when organizations give employees a choice of reducing work hours versus laying people off. And the employees make the choice that we'll all work, take a pay cut, work a little less, furlough, have an extra day a week, for example, so that none of our colleagues are out on the street. Again, but those stories don't happen everywhere, and not every organization is equipped to do that.
Right, right. Now, are you running into a lot of people coming from overseas and that being having to be addressed in these municipalities and companies?
Well, I can, yeah, I think there are different questions for different municipalities. When I came to Minnesota in 1977, the only ethnic food that I could take the police chief candidate, who ultimately got the job, out for, because he had a preference for ethnic food, was wild rice soup and a pastrami sandwich. And that was because we did not have ethnic restaurants. Now, even Minneapolis-St. Paul, which is right in the heartland, has the largest Somalian population in the United States. We have a whole set of streets that have every variety of Asian restaurant that you could think of. We have Ethiopian restaurants. We have restaurants from all over South America and the Caribbean. So we have a different population. And law enforcement, for example, as well as municipalities who deal with housing and everything else, have a different challenge because it is a different population. I'm less, a little bit familiar on the corporate level. I remember when IBM changed their hiring rules to give preferential treatment to IBMers who were laid off elsewhere, who were willing to move and relocate. Rochester, Minnesota had openings, and they were getting employees from Detroit coming to work in Rochester. And these were people for whom Rochester was a foreign land, and these were people for whom those who lived in Rochester were foreign people. And so even though they were Americans, but they were different Americans, and they looked different, and they talked different, and they acted differently. And it was a challenge. It was a challenge. I mean, we talk a lot about diversity, and some parts of the country have embraced it or experienced it at very different degrees than others. And if you don't believe that, just travel. Salida being an example, you know, you walk down the streets of Salida and you don't see the diversity that you do in a city like San Francisco, for example. And that's not just size. That's who we are, where we are, and who moved here, and who's located here, and economics, and all those other issues. So,
okay, getting back a little bit to what they're looking for employees, say, on the human resource level, maybe it might be more interesting to see what they're not looking for as to being more helpful to people. Does that make it?
I'm looking puzzled. You can't see it on radio, but I'm not sure what you mean.
In other words, you go take your tests and you're doing your interview, but if the people knew what they were looking for as opposed to, or what they're not looking for, I mean, it might help them to work on those avenues or not.
I run into this a lot in testing and particularly in law enforcement and fire promotions. You know, it's one thing to do well in a test situation, and a test could be an interview or a written test or anything else. It's another thing to be good at something, really be good at something. And so my job is to create processes that accurately capture who a person is and what their capabilities are, which is a little different than beating the test. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, take an interview. There are people who don't interview very well, and they don't present themselves as well as they could, and they could use some coaching and training on how to do that. But that's different than beating the interview or telling the interviewer what you think they want to hear. That's not helpful for certainly the organization, and it's really not helpful for the person because it potentially puts them in a job for which they're not well suited or capable. And talk about stress. I mean, there's not much more stressful than that because you're going to fail.
Okay, so what factors are usually taken in and looked at when they're doing these interviews? What are they looking for and the processes involved?
Well, again, in part depends on the training and the rigor and the discipline of the organization that's hiring. If untrained interviewers often make their decisions based on first impression and to some extent make decisions often based on themselves. So we tend to like people like us. So, you know, if you put somebody in an interview situation, in a hiring situation, without a lot of training and without the organization having done the groundwork, every interviewer may be looking for slightly different things. What we do is work with organizations to help define, for example, I did some work with an engineering firm in Indiana recently where they have what they call core values, that everybody we hire is going to have certain core values like integrity, like creativity, like a customer service orientation, and that doesn't matter whether they're entry level or senior executives. And so those become at least a foundation. And then, of course, you need specific skills if you're hiring in engineering or IT or accounting or whatever else. So, again, I think when I've worked with organizations in designing hiring systems, usually the result is you get some consistency in what you're looking for, and then you can measure candidates against it, for example. So,
okay, say like you're in an interview situation, you're down to your last few candidates here, and you're having to make that tough decision on which one. This factor that might make somebody shine over the other, is there something they're looking for there in general?
Yeah, I mean, people use words like fit, like chemistry. I mean, it's no different. Think about relationships and think about the people we choose in our lives. You know, if we're making partner decisions, for example, we choose one person over another. What is it? It's not going to be the same in any two situations. It's going to be some more ambiguous thing that we might call chemistry or fit or compatibility. And I think in the work world, I don't think it's that different. I think people make choices. If I have two candidates who are equally capable in terms of the job requirements, it may be that issue of how I resonate with that person may be a factor. And that's harder to quantify. It's harder to put into words. But if you talk to people about why they made certain decisions in hiring, it's often the terms they use. So.
Do you find that sometimes when they're doing these interviews, they're really looking for the tough boss, the tough person, because it takes the heat off of the higher-ups, or does that – no?
I think that kind of really depends on the individual, the organization.
So you don't get – that doesn't really come into play with what you're doing is what you're saying.
Well, again, there may be individuals. I mean, I start with an interesting premise, and not everybody agrees with me because I may be a New Yorker by birth and I may be a hard-nosed cynic by inclination, but I do make the statement that with rare exceptions, everyone wants to do a good job, and that's the people hiring others people, the people being hired, and so – I would hope that more than not, a person who's doing the hiring is trying to find people who will do a good job in whatever we're hiring them for, which ultimately helps the individual, of course, because there's a sense of satisfaction. We derive a great deal of our personal self-worth from work, and quite honestly, helps the organization and the hiring manager. Because let's face it, if you hire somebody who fails, the finger gets pointed at you, as it should, at least early in a career. I always say I'm hard-nosed about it. If you hire somebody and they fail within the first year of the job, not shame on them, shame on you. You didn't hire the right person.
Well, I'm seeing in some of these well-paying jobs, they're now doing these things like contracts where they're only – doing a year or two.
Yeah. They're renting the people instead of purchasing them.
Okay. I mean, and that's another type of strategy that they're working towards?
There was a major loss. Again, it varies, but there was a major lawsuit for Microsoft. Microsoft had a whole workforce of contract employees that they would retain when they needed them, let them go when they didn't, and treated them as independent contractors, which meant they didn't have certain responsibilities financially to them. Well, that was thrown out in court as saying they really weren't independent contractors, that Microsoft was skirting labor law in doing them. And
I ran across this in insurance all the time and real estate. They've been skirting that one forever.
Well, you know, it's... Let's face it, you know, it's economically a cheaper way to go and you don't have the responsibilities. Yeah, I would say there are a number of professions that have utilized the independent contractor route as a cost-saving measure and for other reasons. And again, the courts have ended up being the deciders in a number of those of whether that's appropriate. There's some very – it's like exempt versus non-exempt, having to pay overtime. You know, there are companies that have said, oh, no, you're an exempt employee. We can ask you to work 50, 60 hours a week. And the courts have said, depending on some very strict criteria, no, this is a job where if you're over 40 hours a week, you have to pay time and a half under labor law.
And then you see that sometimes in the salaried – type.
Well, that's the difference. Exempt by the technical terms are you exempt from those regulations? Okay. Are you salaried versus hourly?
Okay.
But organizations have called people salaried when it was not appropriate to do so. And the courts have said, and administrative law judges have said, these are not salaried employees. These are hourly employees, and you need to pay them according to labor law, time and a half and double time, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, I guess going back to when, you know, I was asking you about what they're not looking for, what I guess maybe I should present it in this manner. Okay, so you've got a person that's very well qualified in doing his skill for the job. But if they had some more information on where they might want to work and present themselves in a manner that would help come across better for those interviews or their testing, is there something you might suggest?
Well, let's talk about interviews, for example. Again, any measure of people's capability can be an overestimate. You know, the glib talker in an interview who really doesn't have much substance but can talk a good game, they're going to get potentially a rating higher than they deserve. But you're talking about people, for example, who undersell themselves.
Right.
And there are organizations, services. Most colleges, for example, have career offices that help people. For example, you know, train to be better in interviewing, videotape themselves, get some consultation. And I don't see anything wrong with that. I think if you're underselling yourself or underperforming in that selection tool, that hurts you. And there are some people for whom talking about themselves, for example, is difficult, and they need to get more comfortable at it because, let's face it, your job in an interview is to sell yourself, and it may be the last chance you get if you want that pot of, you know, the brass ring at the end of the tunnel, which is the job. And so, and there are probably community organizations, and certainly those organizations that help retrain people. Some of them have those kind of career counseling services. I know in the private world, we had a part of our business, which we no longer have, was called Career Management Services, which did outplacement. And outplacement is a fancy word for helping people who are let go from a job, often through no fault of their own, reestablish themselves, figure out where they're going next, help them secure a position down the road. And part of that is helping them figure out what they want to do next, but part of them is also helping hone their interview, resume skills, et cetera. When I taught, one of my requirements was that every student in my class had to submit a resume, and I edited the heck out of them and tried to make them better.
So you taught what?
Industrial organizational psychology.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you were teaching that too. Okay.
That was not my day job, but I had two colleges in the Twin City areas that I would moonlight at night.
Ah, okay. So. And did you, in some of this process, when you're doing these this work, did you do your own hiring while you were working with some of these students and the like?
Oh, yeah. I'd certainly hire for my own organization, and I hired for my own, for example, administrative support. And then I would hire some of my students as interns, summer interns, part-time interns, etc. Some of them went on to become full-time employees. Some of them went on to get doctorates in the field. I was just on the phone last week with probably one of my favorite students who now has a professorship in Bozeman, Montana. Got his PhD in both business and industrial psychology at Michigan, and secured a tenure track.
So it's a growing field then?
It is a growing field. It's definitely a growing field. When I started, there were not very many doctoral programs in the country, and there have been kind of an explosion of both master's and doctorate level industrial organizational psychology. Yeah. And, you know, as a firm, we went from 11 people to 1,000. So I think that's reflective of the...
Did you go through a lot of growing pains in that process?
Yeah. Well, you know, the usual. I remember the first time somebody scheduled my time as opposed to me scheduling my time, and I went ballistic. And now we have people who schedule other people's time. I remember when the first time I had to fill out an expense report, you know. We didn't have expense reports. Now we have expense reports, you know. You have to get systematized when you get larger and you know, so those are personal growing pains. All organizations who go from pioneering to kind of consolidating go through that. So
now, do you utilize logic tests or anything of that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
What are you looking for there? They've never made sense to me.
Well, that's what logic. I mean, let's face it. Let's take some professions. If engineers who do things illogically have things fall down and fall apart. And logic is the ability to draw reasonable inferences from information, to separate fact from inference, and to draw logical conclusions from data. That's a basic skill.
Well, you know, I just covered an interview or two on the trivium and quadrivium, and
I don't know
I'm
those
amazed
are.
At how many people don't know what that is, and it's just what you said it was.
Yeah.
But we don't equate the two together anymore, and this is an old, it goes back to some of the classics of in terminology, and when we asked John Gatto about it, I better not even go there and state that, but but what I'm saying is he knew what it was, and that it was a process of gathering data and what you did with that data, but many of us didn't do it in a logical order. And weren't even trained in that method to be able to do that. You know, we start trying to make a decision long before we have all the data. And
in some cases, you never have all the data. you know, it's being able to make sound decisions is certainly a key to a lot of jobs, if not all jobs. And so, you know, logic is, it's along with, you know, for example, we have tests about the ability to learn, which I would argue, again, is part of virtually all jobs, particularly if the jobs are changing and technology requires new knowledge. We need people who can absorb new knowledge and put it to use. And so there are ways to predict that on the front end rather than find out the hard way that someone isn't able to learn it.
I'm going to use this as a for instance, but when I first got into insurance, I think I can't tell you how many times I took their logic test, and they kept turning me down, and they kept turning me down. And finally, I went and wrote the head of the company, and I says, "You've been advertising for this job for 2 years, and can you not find somebody, or what is going on with this testing here?" And after 2 years, I was one of the only ones left out of everybody that'd come through there. And I said, "You may as well throw darts at people on the street." So were you I later on began to wonder, were they really looking for somebody that wouldn't stay?
Probably not. That would be just a little bit too perverse. But again, I don't know the situation. I certainly don't know the test, and I don't know how the test was used. And you basically, you know, again, this is sort of common sense, but it doesn't always work that way. You want to measure the things that are critical and important for the job, and you want to make a distinction between those things you just need enough of versus those things where more is better. So if you're hiring an athlete, you might want to say, yeah, if you can run faster, that's better. Or if you can, if you're stronger, that's better. On the other hand, you might say you don't need to score at the top of a logic test.
Well, the irony about the situation is I got the job because I went to the head of the company who told my boss, but it didn't make for good rapport between me and the boss. But I didn't have to stay there. That was the thing. I got what I needed in the training and whatever, mm-hmm. and moved on. But But it was a learning lesson on my part to find out, you know, the processes that were involved there. So,
and without opening a whole other can of worms, you know, tests are as fallible as in fact, you know, interviews, tests, other people, references, you know, they all have error in them. They all make mistakes. And sometimes they overestimate an ability, and sometimes they underestimate an ability. And so we tend to point their flaws. But, again, the research is pretty clear that if you're using good tools and you're using them correctly, you can up your percentage of correct decisions. You know, the insurance industry, I've worked, for example, in the life insurance industry, and, you know, at the producer level, at the seller level, most folks fail. The percentage of people who stay in the field and are successful is really small. It's in the single digits.
Oh, I'm sure.
And so I remember doing some consulting work and helping them design systems for, I would say, the company that had the best track record in the industry, and I won't name them because I don't think it's appropriate, but they were at 10%. 4 years later, were people performing at an acceptable level, they could claim that 10% of the people they hired were still there doing that. That was a heck of a lot better than the competition.
And I don't doubt that.
Now, there are other organizations or industries where you would say, my gosh, if I didn't have 90% of the people still there 4 years from now performing, I'm doing a lousy job. But, you know, industries differ.
Right. I'm going to go off into a little bit different arena here, and I'm not sure if, you know, you, of course you can decline or just, you know, say you're not qualified or
no
whatever.
Worries.
But sometimes what I'm seeing in the corporate world is a type of psychopathy that takes place. I don't know whether it's the corporation itself or whether there's a merger there.
I can tell you, and there's a guy named Bob Hogan, Robert Hogan from University of Tulsa, who's probably the world's expert on dysfunctional manager, personality of dysfunctional managers. And what happens is, let's face it, to get into management and leadership roles, you have to want to be there. I mean, nobody, right? You know. And among all the people who want to do that, there are some, at least he's identified, some relatively predictable dysfunctional types who end up there. One is he calls the deeply resentful. These are sort of, I'm going to get into a position and get revenge on all the people who wronged me. I'm now going to have power and kind of, you know, get back on all the people who hurt me along the way. The other is the amiable floater who wants to be liked and has difficulty making hard decisions. And he uses certain presidents in the past as examples of that. And then the third one is, and boy, do you see this, the narcissist. People who believe they really are the only ones who can save us, and that no one else has the wisdom, the knowledge, the drive, or whatever to do it, and we need them. And if you look at some of the people who've declared presidential candidates along the way, I think you can see some of that all through at least the two that are more obvious, which is the floater and the narcissist.
Well, when you look at the ultimate goal of a corporation, and you earlier stated that, you know, my mind went blank on the term nonprofit. If it doesn't make money, then it's not going to last. And so you find sometimes that their goals kind of shift somewhere in the process. And I've seen that in even in businesses. When they're making money, they will be as nice as they can be.
It's a whole lot easier to be nice when you're successful. It's a little bit like saying it's a whole lot easier to be happy when you're healthy. It's a lot harder to be happy when you're sick. At the corporate level, it's a whole lot easier to be nice when you're making a profit.
But what I guess what I'm saying is, it's like when these companies would start out and they were, and I think it has a tax implications is what I've identified when I looked at it. But it was when they're on their way up trying to get clients, they will do anything to try to bring you in. But once they hit a certain level, you see them, they can't chase people out fast enough, even though they should be successful. And that's where at times I wondered, and I don't think I'm too far off in making this statement, that there's profit in not making money. And bankruptcy looks like, verging on bankruptcy looks like it can work out for certain things.
That's well beyond my area of expertise,
okay,
so I have no professional opinions on that. And it doesn't make logical sense to me, because, you know, if you think about private industry, your shareholder, that's not. Shareholders aren't going to get very happy, and I would argue that what shareholders tend to do and boards of directors tend to do is replace top leadership when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I can't believe that any people in top leadership roles saying, I want to mess up enough so that the people who I report to are going to get rid of me.
I don't know, but I certainly wonder sometimes with politicians that are running government, but I don't, you know.
Again, I mean,
I know that's outside your area.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men, as the shadow said, you know? So that I couldn't tell you. But I do know, I thought you were going to go someplace that says that, you know, loyal customers are sometimes not treated nearly as well as new prospects. If you don't believe that, look at what you get in your junk mail around the
right.
Deals.
No, I've seen that numerous times.
Yeah,
right.
And when you call up as a customer, they say, no, I'm sorry, that deal's not available to you.
Right. No, I've run into that numerous times.
And my response is, wait a minute, why would you treat someone who hasn't been loyal better than you're treating people who have been? That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And so I do think you get this lack of customer loyalty, you know, cell phones, TV services, all those things where people can – if they have choice, not everyone does, they'll exercise it. So,
okay, do you work in the marketing, work around the marketing areas as far as training people that work in that arena? Is that, again, outside of your total?
That's outside my,
okay.
Yeah, I don't help organizations sell
no,
their product.
I'm trying to find people that are in those arenas. I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, I. You know, being kind of a jack of all trades here, maybe you're an expert at none. It's if you have a particular position in any organization. I mean, I've worked in schools, I've worked in government, I've worked in nonprofits. It really doesn't matter if you basically say, for this particular role or this type of job, what do we need? And once we know what that template looks like, then you can measure candidates against it. So, yeah, I've worked with – we did a study once with Pepsi, I remember, and looking at how are marketing – people in marketing different from people in sales? Because you think of sales and marketing as being very similar. Well, they are, except that the people who gravitate to and are successful in marketing are not the same as people who are good at sales. And a good example would be sales folks often are much more immediate gratification. I mean, you talk to a client, prospect, you make a sale. Marketing is you may be designing something. It takes a year to unfold. So your patience level and your willingness for deferred gratification is far greater in that kind of job than it would be, particularly in a fairly short sales cycle job.
Okay, but when you're looking at, say, like salespeople, you're going to be looking for a total different type of personality, wouldn't you, than somebody that's going to be behind a desk pushing papers? No?
Well, certainly, but there are very few jobs where you sit behind a desk and push papers. You certainly may push more paper than others, but you're going to be on the phone. You're going to be in email.
Okay.
You're going to be meeting with colleagues. So, I mean, again, I think the stereotype of a job where all you do is touch paper probably may exist, but they're pretty rare. That's not the way the world works anymore.
Okay. And as far as when you're dealing with municipalities, do you find some that are much more successful because they have used the, you know, the likes of what you guys do as opposed to the...
I would hope so. I mean, for me, the bottom line is, are we adding value? And, I would say that let me put it this way, as one of the most famous business books out there is a book called Good to Great by Jim Collins, who investigated why certain companies, he happened to do his research in the private world, went from just being okay to being really great and staying there. And the bottom line short story is, it's about having the right people in the right, he called it the right people in the right seats on the bus. And I would argue that if you have the right people in jobs, and particularly key roles and key leadership roles, then the organization works better. It has a much higher probability of accomplishing its mission, whatever that mission may be.
Okay, now, since you've been working with the chiefs of police, do you work around the penal institutions?
I've done some work in corrections, California and New York, for example, where I designed the promotional processes for the prisons. We had 25,000 candidates for sergeant in the California system, and probably close to that in New York. And I got to tour prisons, and I got to spend some time inside, and it's pretty sobering. And again, that's a job that certainly has its unique... let me put it this way. It's not a job I'd ever want to do, be a correctional officer. So.
Right, and is... Do you see much change?
I don't have enough. I don't Not touch prisons. And again, prisons and jails are different. Jails are run at the local level, usually by the sheriff's department, and they vary. But large prison systems, which at one point was a major growth industry in America, I'm not equipped to know enough about. I will say this. I think the idea of rehabilitation for prison is probably diminished as a goal. Right now, just keeping order.
Okay, if you were picking a police chief in this country as opposed to in another country, are they merging it all in the same process?
I have no experience in choosing law enforcement overseas.
I guess training. I guess I'm misunderstanding when you're working with, you know, the police chief situation. What are you doing then? I guess I'm missing something here.
Well, you asked the comparison with other countries, and I don't have that data point. But
Okay. Basically,
if a jurisdiction comes to me and says, we have a police chief vacancy, first thing I do is talk to the key people to find out what is the state of the department, what's needed, what are the challenges, where's it going? And then how does that translate into what do you need in a chief? Do you need a change agent? Do you need someone who can take the organization to the next level? Do you need somebody to instill discipline where it's been lax, et cetera? And then you recruit. You basically put the word out and you get candidates, and then you start looking at the candidates and learning who are they, not just where they've been, that's their experience, but what are they made of? And what are they capable of? And do they have the toolkit to do what's needed for this particular organization? So it's matching capability to need.
Okay.
And letting go of those things that you have to let go of because nobody's perfect. Everybody wants the perfect person, whether it's a spouse or a police chief. They don't exist. So the question is helping the organization know what are you getting.
Okay, if you were going to... we're probably going to go ahead and cut this short, but
when I don't know what your time frame is here.
Okay,
so
it's 22. So
and what time do you? What time does the show go to?
In 20 minutes. It's from
okay.
8 to 10.
That's
okay.
Fine. Okay. That's good.
Right.
I can live with that.
Okay.
So
all right. Well, let me go somewhere that's more fun for you. And I know that you, and this is stepping out away from what the regular part of the interview was about, but I know that you're very involved in bicycling.
I am. It's what got me to Salida. So.
And do you find that with what you're doing, does it really open doors for you? No?
Well, I don't know what you mean by that.
With your occupation.
Oh, well, I don't so much open doors because I'm at a point where, you know, I'm not looking for doors to open. I'm actually trying to – it's kind of like having enough possessions. I don't need more stuff and I don't need more doors. But, I mean, I think biking would be a good example. There's a national organization called the League of American Bicyclists, which is dedicated to making America bike-friendly. And on an international scale, we are not. Europe, for example, is far ahead of us in terms of our major cities being accessible by bike and safe to bike in, et cetera. So about 6 years ago, I ran for the board of the League of American Bicyclists and got elected by the membership. I think we have about 50,000 members around the country. And have served, this is the end of my, I think I'm in my second or third term on the board. And I'm secretary of the board, so I'm part of the executive committee. And it isn't so much that my background opened the door, it's that I think I've brought some skills and been able to be part of the organization. And in the same way that I ran for the board of CAHAN and, you know, ended up as board chair here. And again, just some organizational skills and working with people and trying to further the mission. Again, community radio here and making America bike-friendly there are both things that I'm passionate about. So
did you have a background in radio before you?
Oh, no. I had a love of music from the time I was probably 7 years old. I plugged a radio into my ear. But unfortunately, somewhere along the line, I learned that I had very little talent in producing it. And so I have collected music, I've gone to concerts, I've shared music all my life. And in fact, if there are people listening who know CAHAN's history, I met Dave Ward here before I moved here and began to share some music with him and talk music. And he said, you should consider being a DJ. And I actually toyed with that idea back in college, so but never had time for it or never got to do it. And so I went ahead and followed through and did my and anyone in Salida can come before the programming committee with a concept and an idea and pitch it. And I had some ideas and about sharing music, and the programming committee said, go ahead. And I went on the air Valentine's Day in February, and so I guess I'm somewhere over half a year now and still enjoying it. And my sign-off at the end of my shift at the end of the night is, remember, it's never too late to have a happy childhood. So I'm having fun. I'm having a great time. So.
Well, it sounds like it, because I've heard you talk a little bit about your bicycling experiences.
Yeah. That's, bike club here is great. And if there are any SCR, South Central Racing folks listening, right on. Yeah, it's a great group of people to bike with. So. And a great place to bike. So.
And as far as, you know, the opportunity of community radio, we really do have something that a lot of places people don't get that opportunity to just jump right in and get their feet wet.
Well, and this town is I think, unique and special in a lot of ways. And I keep saying that for a town of our size and our population, we just have more things happening than we deserve. And, you know, more power to us, and I'm grateful for it. And it makes living here, you know, quite honestly, I worry is too strong a word, but my wife and I both had some concerns about, you know, would a town of this size, we're both big city people, our backgrounds are large metro areas for our entire lives. And let's face it, the nearest big metro area is 100 miles away, if you consider Colorado Springs big and metro. And yet, we're never bored in Salida, let's put it that way. And the opportunity to get involved in this community is just great. I mean, there's a lot of need, certainly, but there's also lots of opportunity to contribute. So it's been 2 years, and yet, I think it's also fairly, people have been very open to us, and I think that's great.
You know, I'm amazed at how many people are like you that I run into here that have backgrounds that are just, you know, vast and come from various.
Somebody once said that the skill and education level of the folks in this area are unbelievable when you tap it. And in fact, there's an individual here, and I think I can use names here, named Irv Browdy, and Irv comes from Educational Testing Service. And he's actually sponsoring an initiative of trying to recruit people with skills and talents to provide programming for that missing fifth day for Salida students. Now that they're going to a four-day school week, could people in this community be offering things that would be of interest to students and be of benefit to students that they now have an extra full day to take advantage of?
And, you know, Cahan is a great opportunity there, and I would love to
We've had
to
that
see.
Conversation about, yeah, think about young people getting an opportunity to get their, I don't know if their mouth's wet or their hands wet or, you know.
Feet wet.
Feet wet in radio, in communication. I mean, what a great opportunity.
I mean, because there's so many different, yeah, there's so many different areas. And this isn't just for students. I mean, this could be anybody because we're always looking for volunteers.
Always.
And we certainly can use people volunteering for helping the fundraising and
putting on events, coordinating and connecting with businesses who provide underwriting. There are all sorts of ways. Thinking of new and different ways we can contribute and connect to the community. You know, we have a medium, we have a technology, we have a certain capability. How do we use that to really further and help Salida and the environs, you know, be all they can be?
I mean, when I walked in here, I had no background, no experience at all, and, you know, even I've gotten to really interview some incredible people, and I still wonder, why me? But I when I have a question and I want to explore a subject, I just email them and I write them and I get to do these interviews. Now, there wasn't really a lot of the people going outside of this area that I'm aware of when I joined the Cahan. But I mean, there's an opportunity in the talk arena. But then there's also some people with some great music background, and we've got some, you know, incredible musicians in our area. And if you want to get into the technical aspects of radio, I mean, there's all kinds of things that people can do to get experience here and for little to no cost. As far as the person is involved, but we can always use, you know, funds here. Don't get me wrong. Some of us have to support ourselves in our learning process. But
that's true. And I do say, as board chair, we are a not-for-profit, and one of our challenges is always raising the capital to just keep the lights on and the equipment running, because as opposed to a lot of organizations, this equipment is on and running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I will tell you, it does break, and technology changes, and we need to upgrade and all those things. So, yeah, supporting. And speaking of which, if I can put in a shameless plug, we are having a fundraising event. It's a music swap this Saturday at the Salida Cafe, noon to 3. And a music swap means sellers and buyers of instruments, audio gear, and music coming together and swapping. And Cahan, as a fundraiser, will give the sellers 80% of sale price, and 20% goes to support your community radio. So this Saturday, if you have anything to sell, bring it by the Salida Cafe at noon. Actually, sellers, you can come at 11. And if you have anything you want to buy, or just browse. And we do have a live band, because we always believe that having a party is a good thing. So the Salida Cafe, and hopefully the weather will comply, will have a band on the deck, and one of our local musicians and his friends are going to play the music. They're going to call themselves the Chicken Scratch String Band. So I don't know what to expect, but it should be a rockin' good time.
And there's so much that we are always looking for new underwriters as well. I mean, we really could even use help in people working along the lines of helping to bring in these underwriters and approach the underwriters.
That's right. Yeah, this community radio needs support. You've all heard pledge drives, and there's that support, and there's all the support that happens behind the scenes and underwriting and helping local businesses get their word out. At the same time, supporting local radio is a key pillar of our existence, so it's critical.
And there's so many different areas that we could even expand that we don't have right at the moment, but I've often thought, boy, if we just had somebody out there that was into getting news and wanted to follow up on that, I'm sure the community would love to see something with a regular format there.
That'd be great to have a local news program that could be, you know, hard-hitting and on the moment and when things were happening. So a lot of dreams, and we got to start. You got to walk before you run. So I guess we're approaching 9 years in existence.
And, is it that long already?
In February it'll be 9. Yep. And in fact, we will have a birthday party as we always do in February. I think we're poised as a radio station to look at the community and maybe connect with the community and ask the questions about what should we be, who should we be, what's our role and function in this community of Salida, and get a better handle on that, and then figure out strategies to meet it, both financially and expertise and programmatically and everything else. So it's a work in progress, folks. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've noticed, you know, after I'm going on 5 years coming up here, is that people that have been here a while, you know, they get the brunt. And so we are always needing volunteers to come in and join us and find out, you know, expand the horizons. And so I'm hoping that, you know, we're this making an appeal for volunteers and people for DJs and fundraising. So again, I know we're coming to the point here that we'll be ending the interview, but I felt that, you know, since you're on the president of the board of directors, that this is part of what we need to do is get the word out and get more support from the community, and we want to support the community more. So it takes us. It's kind of a give and take.
Definitely, it's a two-way street. We're a piece of the larger puzzle, and when it works together, it's a beautiful thing. And so, I'm really enjoying it. I'm feeling it's a great way for me to connect to, first of all, a wonderful group of people. We call our volunteers the peeps. And they are truly a dedicated, talented, fun group of people, and I like fun people. And so I've always found that volunteer work is you get more than you give. And
well,
so
this is one, and to kind of tie this back into what we originally started with on the interview, one of the things that John Taylor Gatto had brought up is that volunteering and that community thing was when he interviewed, I guess you could say, some CEOs and people that he knew, that was very important, very important. And to really think that you just have that academic background, but if you're not participating in the community, that's more of the well-rounded area that he was told they look for.
And I certainly, in hiring, look for, you know, you ask what are people looking for, and if I had to boil it down to its, you know, ultra simplistic essence, I would say good head and good heart. So a good head meaning making good decisions and being able to do the right thing, but without a good heart. And I think volunteering, in my mind, is evidence of a good heart. You're giving of yourself to something larger than yourself. And you know, if you don't have that, that really makes you pretty one-dimensional, and in my mind, less likely to really be a positive contributor to whatever it is, because your view is way too narrow. And I think that certainly when I'm looking at resumes or I'm looking at people, I'm looking for evidence of, and I can't speak for all corporations certainly, but I know one of the questions we ask cops in promotion is, how have you gotten involved with your community over and beyond your job? And we give credit for that. And I haven't met a chief yet who doesn't think that that's an important piece of what they want in their command level people. So,
okay.
And Cahen, I guess, sort of to wrap that one back around, Cahen's a great place to do it.
Right. No, really. Like I said, I not only learned how to get on the radio and do interviews, but I had to learn how to edit and record and do many other aspects and help fundraise. And I've learned quite a bit, and I've got a whole lot more to learn.
And I want to take the opportunity to thank Melody, because she is the instrumental point person for our underwriting. And without her, one of the three legs of our stool, which is membership, underwriting, and grants and donations, wouldn't be there. And, you know, a stool without three legs doesn't stand up very well. So,
well, I want to say, Harry, I think you've been a gracious guest. And even though we had a little rough start, I think we got along just...
That was hours ago. And we didn't have a rough start. We just started rough. We've had a good time. And I'm looking at my clock going, oh, my gosh, it's time flew. So.
Yes, and so we're going to have music mix coming up next. But, again, I want to thank Harry and keep up the good work. And I'm sure you're a busy guy, but you know how to have fun, too.
Absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity. So, Melody, thanks so much.
And thank you.